One of the greatest stocking stuffers you can give a runner is some Tailwind single-serving packets.
Hey, that sounds like a good idea, Scott.
If you go to tailwindnutrition.com, or you can link over to from our partners page at trailrunnernation.com, you can get a sample pack of the single-serving packets, which include all four of the flavors.
You know, we have a podcast coming up in another week we're going to release with Andy Du Bois talking about sodium. And one of the takeaways from that is that savory, salty content going across the back of the tongue that might be a secret in decreasing cramps.
And I got to tell you, I just made a mistake.
Okay.
It's five flavors in the sample pack. You get the lemon, you get the orange, you get the berry, you get the naked, and you get Don's favorite, the caffeinated raspberry buzz.
Oh yeah, that's the way you start a run.
For $11.35, you can do a great stocking stuffer for your running friend.
And while you're at it, put quantity two so you can get one for yourself. Are you kidding me?
It's the giving season. It's also a selfish season.
It's a time to give to yourself. And what better thing to give, Scott? I mean, when you're out there running, it's nice to just knock back some Tailwind.
So go to trailrunnernation.com, hit the partners button, and there's a link right there. It takes you straight to Tailwind Nutrition.
Easy to do. Even Santa could do it.
Don just used the Petzl head torch on his last 100-miler.
I did, Scott, and I tell you, I put on the Now, and I couldn't have been, I was like a proud father, like as if I had helped give birth to that.
It's because you lit up 50 miles of that 100-miler. All of a sudden, everybody could see. It's like the sun rose again.
There's a spot that it was dark time, and we were putting on the headlamps or torches, and coming down a road, an actual road that's going downhill, and a couple runners were ahead of me. In fact, a lot of runners were ahead of me. But these two in particular said, "Is that a car behind us?" And I realized it was me and the Petzl Now. But there's a reason they thought it was a car, Scott. I had that thing on full blast mode.
Which is like 550 lumen, yeah.
Straight out of my forehead. And you need to be careful with the settings on there. You can go high blast or you can go reactive lighting. And the reactive lighting is the smart use of your battery.
Yes.
It only gives you car-like features when you need it and then backs off a bit when you're on single track.
And most of the time you're looking just right in front of you, and so it backs that lumen back and gives you more of a peripheral lighting source, which doesn't take as much battery.
So I think my tip for the lighted trail with light on it,
yeah,
would be make sure you're in reactive mode and not full blast mode if you need to go for a distance. And that's something a person should know, because those batteries are so well designed to make sure they last a long time. In fact, what a cool thing is, they have a software program that you can go in and manipulate the use of that battery life so it will extend to the number of hours you need to run.
Yeah.
And not every head torch does that.
I can't think of any head torch that does that.
Well, Scott, they had it back in the caveman days when you just got a longer stick. And if you needed to go a long time, it was very tall.
Or you burnt your fingers.
One of the two.
Go to Petzl.com, go to our partners page, and link over to Petzl. They have the best head torches on the planet.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
This might be one of the most interesting podcasts ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing. There's a bunch of, like, old brothel hookers, like, buried out here.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott Warr. And today we have Dr. Jim Taylor. That may sound familiar to you because he was on a podcast that we did earlier that we'll link to this podcast. It was on mental toughness. He's an internationally recognized authority on the psychology of performance in business, sport, and parenting. And we picked up on some articles that Dr. Jim Taylor was writing on the fear of failure. And the first part of that, I picked it up and I read it and I went, wow, that's good. And I said, hey, Don, we gotta get Dr. Taylor on the phone and talk to him about this. And he was in the process of writing the other three parts of this article. And so we decided to wait until all of them were published, and we'll link the URL so you can read all of these and get the details of these. But we want to welcome Dr. Jim Taylor and thank him for coming on the podcast. Talk about the fear of failure.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was fun last time, so I'm sure we'll have fun this time.
Awesome. Hey, you know, and Dr. Taylor, as I dove into part one, I recognize that you're singing the story of my life. And as I was reading through that, I wrestled all of those things that you're talking about, and I started to wonder how many others of us wrestle those same fears and those same obstacles through life. And because I've only live in me, I don't live in other people, but I was comforted to find out that someone like yourself is addressing it, so there must be others.
And yeah, fear of failure is absolutely epidemic in our culture, and I think it's very evident in endurance athletes as well. So that, you know, if there wasn't a need, I wouldn't have written the article. So that's how I look at it.
Good point.
Well, the one thing that if you go back, if our listeners go and read the four parts of this, it's kind of skewed towards children athletes. But as I read it, my wife would consider me sometimes a child, mm-hmm. but I don't consider myself a child. And I think that it applies to me today, and it also applies to me today in life and business, and we'll get into that in a little bit later in the podcast. But talk to us first about the introduction to the fear of failure. Why is this such an epidemic?
Sure. Well, a couple of reasons. First of all, we live in a culture that absolutely reveres success and vilifies failure. If you fail, not only are you a failure, but you are the biggest loser, to use a reality TV show reference. So there's a lot of pressure on being successful. And it used to be success was determined by the people around you in your neighborhoods, your communities, your schools, your jobs. But now our point of reference is the world because of the internet. And because of expansions in social media and all these different avenues by which we learn about how other people live. So the bar for success now is so high. You have to be rich, you have to be powerful, you have to be beautiful, you have to be or handsome, or you have to have a ton of stuff. And that's hard to live to. That's hard to both attain and even aspire to. At the same time, I think, especially with kids and parents and families, there's tremendous pressure on the part of parents to make sure that their kids are successful. Two reasons for that. One is there's a tremendous amount of financial and economic uncertainty and anxiety that parents feel, like, oh my gosh, my kid's not going to be able to get a job and support themselves, and they're going to move back in with me. And also, I think with greater affluence and with greater disposable income and time, parents have more time to worry about how their kids are to do, and more time to connect their children's achievements and their children's successes and failures with themselves. So when kids succeed and fail, it is the reflection on the parents, both positively and negatively.
Yeah, and today with social media, there's really no way to hide from any failure because it's broadcast in multiple directions in big ways.
Right. And so not only do a few people know that you might have failed at something, but the world knows. And how incredibly awful is that? Despite the fact that, of course, most people don't care the least about any of us because they have their own problems to think about. And they're worrying about themselves and they're worrying about what we think of them, which, of course, is a waste of time.
Hey, so maybe we need to, I know I do, maybe we need to put a new definition to failure, because right now it has that, from what you just said, a huge negative connotation. Failure is the worst thing that could happen
loser.
To you. Loser. But maybe failure shouldn't be that. Maybe it shouldn't conjure up that kind of image in our head. How should we think about failure?
Well, not at all. I mean, if you think about it, and this is, I think, a good entry point to our discussion of fear of failure in terms of what it really is. If you think about it, is failure really worth fearing?
And though it's certainly a bummer when it happens, it's not fun, it's not enjoyable. The fact is, the most successful people in every walk of life throughout history failed frequently and monumentally on the way to success. So failure is absolutely essential for you to improve, grow, develop, move out of your comfort zone, find success. The only way truly not to fail is to sit where you are. Mm. Although I would suggest that that is the worst kind of failure, because you're giving up and not even trying to find out what you're capable of. And so the key here is this idea that failure is really is actually a really good thing. And I use a couple of examples. J.K. Rowling, her Harry Potter books were rejected by 33 publishers before a formerly small publisher named Scholastic bought the rights. Have you heard of Formula 409, the cleaning product?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's purple, I think, in the inside of that bottle.
Hello?
Yeah.
Right. And do you know why it's called Formula 409? Well, because the first 408 iterations of the product didn't work.
Wow.
Now, whoever invented 409, I have to hand it to him, because I probably would have quit after about 106 tries. But he or she hung in there, and now it's the number one cleaning product in the world or what have you. So I think redefining success and failure is really important. But again, it's hard to do.
You know, in part two, you made a very visual metaphor in my mind where you talked about failure as a kitty cat versus a perceived mountain lion. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah. Before I do that, let me step back one bit and sort of take the next step in our understanding of fear of failure. So I think we've established that failure is not worth fearing. So what's the fear? Well, it's about the meaning that people attach to failure. And so there's something about failure that they attach a meaning to that makes it worth fearing in their eyes. And there's been some great research on this, both with adults and with kids. And the researchers have found that the most common ones are, my parents won't love me, my friends won't like me, society will label me a loser, all of my efforts will have been a waste, or I can't accept that I'm simply not going to achieve my goals. So again, it's that idea that failure is there's the meaning attached to it. Now, to your question about the different forms of felines, for people with a fear of failure, they are really not concerned about success. If success is on your right and failure is on your left, they're not looking to their right at success and pursuing it. Their overriding goal in life is to avoid failure. Because if failure is, in fact, a mountain lion, guys, what is that mountain lion going to do if it catches you?
Kill you.
It's going to eat you and kill you. So failure becomes a life or death situation. But the reality is, and this is where I try to bring a little levity and a little bit of visual meaning here, is that failure is not a mountain lion. Failure will not kill you in most cases, unless maybe you're Alex Honnold. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, the free solo rock climber,
mm-hmm.
where in that case, failure, yes, you will die. But in most cases, failure won't result in your death. So failure is not a mountain lion. It's a kitty cat. Now, can a kitty cat hurt you? Yes, it can scratch you, it can bite you, it can hurt for sure. But will a kitty cat kill you? Well, no, it won't. Just like failure, will it feel bad? Yes. Will you feel disappointment? Yes. But in fact, disappointment is actually a great thing, because disappointment is wired into us from when we're cave people, that when we're disappointed, our natural reaction is to go back out there and try to succeed in the future. Just like you go out back in the Serengeti 250,000 years ago when we were cave people, the hunters would go out and throw their spears, and if they didn't have disappointment wired into us, they'd give up, they'd go back to the cave, and their wife would say, where's the mastodon? And they would starve and they wouldn't pass on their genes. So somehow disappointment got wired into us, so when we got disappointed, we'd pick up the spear and keep throwing until we got the mastodon or whatever prehistoric animal we were hunting at the time. So failure is obviously not a pleasant thing, but it is an essential thing.
Dr. Taylor, a moment ago before we went off on Scott's cats and kitties, you were talking about potentially disappointing others or disappointing parents and risking that. But can we talk for a second about disappointing ourselves, who we have built the facade that we built of our own personality, our own ego, of who we think we are, who we want to be. And if we go out there and challenge that, we could disappoint ourselves. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, because certainly once you become an adult, it's unlikely that your concern for your parents and how they feel about you is that important. But what very often happens is if we grow up in an environment, in a family where failure is unacceptable, then we internalize it. So we don't need our parents around when we're 25, 45, 65 to tell us, oh, you failed, you're a loser. We internalize that, and that becomes our yardstick. And so because of that, then we often are reluctant to, for example, take risks. And we can talk about that a little more. And we're unwilling to put in a full effort, because if we fail, that hurts our self-esteem, how we view ourselves. We all like to think we're incredibly competent and capable, and that we can in fact be successful. But the reality is we can't always be successful. And it happens to the best of them. Peyton Manning last week in Denver had maybe the worst game of his career, while ironically setting a new NFL mm-hmm. record for the most yards in a game. Not in a game, in a career. So it becomes a threat to how we view ourselves that we fail. And that can be very crushing as well, because nobody likes to think that we're not incredibly capable and wonderful and able to be successful.
So you the one thing that I really liked about at least the first part of your article series is you describe how people avoid failure. It's not just simply, I mean, there some people just say, nope, I'm just not going to participate. I mean, that's one way. What are some other ways that people can avoid failure?
Sure. There are three ways. And this is one of the most interesting parts of this discussion of fear of failure. The first way, as you suggest, is that one way to not fail is to not play the game. You know, you can't fail if you don't take the shot. And so you see a lot of people, for whatever reason, dropping out of the pursuit of whatever. And this can be a very extreme case. Like very often, alcoholism, drug abuse is a way to escape, a way to not play the game of life in this case, because they don't think they can handle life and be successful at life. But it can also be a kid who doesn't want to play baseball anymore, or an endurance athlete who doesn't think they can go the distance anymore. And so that's sort of the easy way out. But that's relatively less common, because very often, you know, there are certain things we simply have to do. The second way to avoid failure is to become successful. Because if you think of this continuum where failure's on the left and success is on the right, well, one way to avoid failure is to get as far away from failure as possible. And so as long as you have distance between you and failure, nobody's going to call you a failure. But here's the problem. I see many people, including endurance athletes, get stuck in what I call their safety zone. And this is where they're far from failure, so they can go, man, I'm okay. Nobody's going to think I'm a failure. But they really want to be successful. A part of them, a healthy part of them, really wants to be successful. But to do that, to be truly successful at most things in life, you have to take risks. So it might be in an ultra run, you know, pushing the pace, going out a little faster at the start, or overcoming the pain at the end. And yet, for somebody who is more motivated to avoid failure than to pursue success, they're not going to take those risks. Because, yes, to become successful, you must take risks. But an inherent aspect of risk is that you might fail. And again, for somebody who is motivated to avoid failure, they're not going to be willing to take those risks. So that's number two. You guys want to jump in here?
Can I say something about number two? So
sure.
The greater the success, is it inherently greater the risk? Is there a correlation there?
No, I mean, it's incredibly so. The higher up you get, the farther you have to fall. And so that's why fear of failure tends to rear its ugly head as somebody becomes more successful, because there are greater expectations, there's greater pressure, and you can fall farther. Because if you're already near the bottom, you don't have anything to lose. But if you're way up there, you have a lot to lose.
So are you saying that or thinking that regardless of who you are and what level of success you achieved, you're always wrestling with this potentially wrestling with this fear of failure, or at least the risk of failure?
Well, potentially, but only if you define failure in a way that feeds into this fear of failure, that it is, that it is in fact a really awful thing to be avoided, and it is life or death for me. Again, not physically, but it's sort of psychically, psychologically.
Okay, got it. That's a good answer.
I have a question for you, Doctor. You know, I know that you work with the U.S. ski team, or have worked with the U.S. ski team. So I'm going to throw some U.S. ski team names out there, like Bodie Miller, Lindsey Vonn, these racers that have really achieved high levels of success. Are the ones that are truly seeing high levels of continued success, like a Bodie Miller or a Lindsey Vonn, are they the ones that have overcome this fear of failure, or are they the ones that may be victims of this fear of failure?
Sure. Well, I have I've worked with a lot of U.S. ski team athletes over the years, because that's my own athletic background. And but I haven't worked with Bodie, and though I knew Lindsey many years ago when she was about 13, I have never worked with her as well. Bodie Miller, for me though, is my poster child of the attitude you want to have about success and failure. Mm-hmm. Because Bodie never cared about results. All he ever cared about, and this is from his autobiography, all he ever cared about was skiing as fast as humanly possible. And he could have finished 16th, but if he felt like he skied as fast as he could, he was a happy guy.
Mm-hmm.
As for Lindsey, she's a little more complex creature, and I don't want to put her on the couch too much here, but I would say she's somebody who has definitely had to struggle with fear of failure and has learned to manage it effectively. Otherwise, she couldn't have reached the level she was at, and she certainly couldn't have come back from the serious injuries that she came back from, almost 2 years worth, to last year have an incredibly successful season.
So I have a million questions, and I could probably spend a lifetime on your couch.
Well, do we need to get to the third?
Well, I want to ask him this question.
Yeah.
Oh, we get to third, and then I'll ask this question. Go ahead, Scott. Thanks.
So what's one of the what's the number three way that people avoid fear of failure?
Sure. Well, this is the most interesting and the most psychologically and emotionally complex. It's when people engage in what's called self-sabotage or self-defeating behavior. It's when they do things that actually guarantee failure. And so they might you know, give up at the end of a race. Or they might feign an injury, or say, you know, I'm injured. Or they might not prepare as well as they could. And so here's the interesting thing here. So they do things that guarantee failure. But all these actions that they engaged in that led to failure actually provide them with something that protects them. And that is an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have been successful in the race, but you know, I just kept getting this cramp. I would have been successful, but I just didn't have the time to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
And so that excuse protects people by saying that I'm still okay, and that you still have to think I'm a worthwhile person, or I have to still think I'm okay because I have this excuse, because I would have been successful. The sad thing about that is that it is ultimately self-defeating, because the fact is you still fail. I mean, I've been in a lot of running races in my life, and there was never a line in the results sheet that said, excuse.
Exactly.
It was just your time. And of course, excuses are like elbows. Everybody has one or two, but they don't do you a lot of good. I guess elbows do, but anyway.
I don't think the metaphor I heard was elbows.
I know, but I didn't want to. I figured it was a PG rated show.
I know. I'm just joking.
So the point is here is that people do these things that cause themselves to fail, and yet they have this fear of failure. And if it's okay, can we lead into the next part of this discussion, or you want to ask a question?
Well, just a quick comment, and then bookmark where that next phase of the discussion goes. And sometimes you hear these excuses early on in a trail race or any race. Yeah, you know, my knee is bad, and I don't know if I'm going to even finish this one, or I haven't really. This is just a training run for me, not a real race. I mean, sometimes people will position themselves.
So they'll make up excuses before
the outcome.
Yeah.
They don't even know. They're just they just have a safety net built in.
Yeah, that's called self-handicapping, and it's a way of lowering expectations, and also it's a way of if you're self-critical, then people are less likely to be critical of you. So it's a way of sort of preventing perceived criticism from others, even though, of course, nobody cares, but we all like to think people care. So we say, gosh, you know, I've been really sick all week, or I'm injured, or I'm really tired, or I'm not prepared, and so people will think, oh, well, they're not going to do very well. And two upsides to this. One is if you don't do well, then there's no surprises, so nobody's going to say, oh, you know, he was all red and he didn't do very well. And if you do well, then you're heroic, because even though the fact that you're injured and sick and aren't prepared, you still had a great race. Man, that's amazing. You're not only successful, you're a superstar. And so people do these things to protect themselves. The problem is that ultimately protection doesn't protect them from failure, which leads into another point. Shall I go there?
Right after this quick comment. Is it possible to perform well if you self-sabotage yourself? Are there some people that have self-sabotaged and then had the race of their life? Or do you mentally take yourself out?
It depends. It can potentially lead to a great performance because it takes the pressure off. It takes the threat of failure away. And because ultimately that's the goal, is to take away that threat. This is not the healthiest way to do it, because often it can be turned from self-handicapping, that is lowering expectations, to self-sabotage, which is you actually actively cause yourself to fail, though of course not consciously.
I'm ready to move to the next one.
Yeah,
okay.
On the edge of my seat.
So you see, guys, you see this sort of conflict between somebody who has a fear of failure and yet they're causing themselves to fail. So I pondered this for a long time, and I finally figured it out, at least from my perspective, that people aren't afraid of failure. They're afraid of total failure. Oh. Now, here's how I define total failure. Giving it everything you've got, doing everything you possibly can, and not achieving your goals. Now, I ask this question of thousands of people I speak to every year, tens of thousands, and 99.9% of them say, not only is total failure a bad thing, it is the worst possible thing. Why? Because if you had experienced total failure, what do you have to admit about yourself? You're just not good enough.
Right.
And nobody wants to admit that. Even though the reality is, unless you're on top of the podium at the Olympics or getting the first place ribbon, and you were aiming for that, everybody else except the winner has to accept that realization. Because we all have limitations, of course. But what I suggest to people is that, though it's not, I would say it's not the goal, but it's a goal. So why would total failure be a goal? I mean, what's good about that? Well, to give you some perspective, here's my definition of total success: giving it everything you've got and achieving your goals. Mm-hmm. Good or bad thing? Well, most people think it's a trick question, but it's not. Total success is a great thing. But what do total success and total failure have in common? Given it everything you've got. And ultimately, that's all you can do. That might enable you to achieve your goals, and sometimes it might not. But here's an important realization. If you don't give it everything you've got zero chance of achieving your goals. And so I would rather be somebody who gives it everything they've got and fails than someone who doesn't give it everything they've got and fails. Because there's one emotion that I try to live by, that I try to avoid in my life and try to convey to the people I work with. One emotion you never want to experience after a race, after a season, after a career, on your deathbed. Guys, what is that emotion?
Regret. You don't want any regret.
Right. And because what's regret? It means I wish I had done something differently. And of course, we all could have little regrets here and there. But in the big things in our lives, I want to look back and say, I took my shot at every opportunity. And they didn't work out very well. They didn't all work out very well. But my belief is if you do give it everything you've got, good things are going to happen. Now, I say that good things are going to happen instead of find success or win, because how successful you are depends on a lot of things. If you're an athlete, it's a lot of your genes. And so I can't say that it's going to result in an Olympic gold medal or whatever it might be. But I can say that if people take their shot and give their best effort, sooner or later something good's going to happen. And that's way better.
Growing up, I heard that a lot, and I should be thankful for that, because I think there was a lot of wisdom in what my dad had done. Is he would say, I don't care how you do, what the outcome is, as long as you've done your best. And a lot of us hear that. I don't care if you're sweeping floors or you run the company. If it's your best effort, then you're successful, and cherish that and move on with that. And so I think that was a good seed that he planted long ago.
Yeah, and you hear that all the time from parents, and especially mm-hmm. I'm not gonna comment on your father and how honest he was about that, but you know, most parents are BSing their kids.
Hey, can we go offline for a second?
We don't want this to get personal, but yeah, I mean, that's sort of a classic line from parents. Mm-hmm. And but the fact is, you know, if you don't these days, especially if kids don't reach a certain level of sort of acceptable success, then parents are going to be kind of probably disappointed.
Sure.
But anyway, that issue of total failure, that's really what the fear is. And actually, it's not. And we can then go to the, you know, maybe my article number 3 on this. But at the bottom of it is that fear of total failure, of having to admit that I'm just not good enough, because you can't change I'm just not good enough. Sure, you can train harder, you can learn more stuff, but we all have our intellectual and our athletic and physical limits.
Jim, one of the things that I absolutely...
And one sort of final thing about that is that this whole... Oh, let me just finish one more point, is that this whole Malcolm Gladwellian view of 10 years, 10,000 hours, it's a crock. It's an absolute crock.
Yeah.
And the fact is, your genes matter. They matter a lot. But you can't control your genes. I mean, I didn't become – I competed internationally as a ski racer, but I never became truly world class. And it was because I just didn't have good enough genes. I'm not a big guy. And should I blame my parents for that? Of course. But because they gave me the genes. But at the same time, you know, they didn't have control over it either. So I believe in focusing on things we have control over, which is our effort, our diligence, our focus, our attitude, all those other things.
What I was going to say, Jim, that's excellent stuff. What I was going to say that I like about the ultra running community and the trail running community is a lot of times we celebrate that person or that athlete that did leave it all out on the course. Last year at the Western States 100, which is kind of the Grand Prix of ultra running,
yeah.
The big story was that person, Grunhild
Swanson,
that came in 6 seconds before the cutoff, the 30-hour cutoff. You know, it was one of the biggest stories in the ultra running community, and I think that's maybe something that we can do as a society is celebrate not total failure, but taking the risk and accomplishing a personal best.
Absolutely. And the fact is, I wouldn't call it a failure. It's an amazing success to run Western States. I've had a bunch of friends who run it. And just the idea of just thinking about doing it, I find incredibly tiring. And and the fact that they finish, I don't care if they finished 3 hours after the cutoff. For me, you go that far, that's a major victory. Because ultimately, you know, one thing I really always emphasize is that let's use the example of Western States. There are actually 3 races going on there within that one race. The first race is the obvious one against competitors. But before runners can win that race, they have to win the second race, and that is against the conditions. The terrain, the trail conditions, the weather, the mm-hmm. elevation. But so without overcoming those conditions, there's no way somebody can be competitive and be successful against their competitors. But before that, they have to win the mental race. And that, of course, is the one against themselves, because that is the most profound challenge of endurance sports. It's not beating other people. I mean, that's a great thing. You can finish 64th. You can finish 17,000th at Chicago Marathon, and that's a huge victory, because the real victory is overcoming ourselves, overcoming our limitations, our doubts, our worries, our fears. And that is a massive victory. And by the way, if you can overcome those challenges, and that's why a lot of people come to me, is because they can't do it on their own, then again, good things are going to happen, because our greatest obstacle is ourselves.
One of the phrases that you wrote in your article that I have underlined and highlighted and have stars and asterisks by is...
It's a tattoo, isn't it? Now, Scott?
It's going to be.
Yeah.
To achieve total success, I must be willing to accept total failure.
Absolutely. That is
brilliant.
One of my great, most important sayings. And it just sums it up, is that you cannot achieve real success in life. I mean, success being defined as performing to the very best of your ability. And again, that might be Olympic gold medal. It might mean finishing 87th in Grandma's Marathon or Western States or whatever. But you can't do that unless you can accept that you might experience total failure. Because a lot of people think that total failure is this life or death thing, like you're going to die. And again, not physically, but you're going to feel like a total loser. But the fact is, you'll survive. Disappointed? Yes. Bummed out? Yes, if you experience total failure. But it's not a life-threatening experience. And ironically, by accepting that you might fail and have no excuses because you put everything out there, you have a far better chance of finding success, however that's defined, whatever your kind of capabilities are, finding that success. And so being able to just, I'm not going to swear, but I've actually written about this. Mm-hmm. I call it the F it attitude. And I think you guys can figure out what F stands for. And it's just saying F it, you know, to the results, not to the experience, but to the results. Because if you can just say F it to the results, then that liberates you. That frees you from any of those fears. Because if you don't care about failure, if you're not attached to failure, then it can affect you. And that it's the metaphor I use is this, guys. You're about to begin Western States. Somebody comes over and makes you put on a 50-pound weight vest. How are you gonna feel? Weighed down, heavy, sluggish. How are you gonna run? Darn slow. So another metaphor here is that's the weight vest, the metaphorical weight vest that people put on with a fear of failure. So it's just like take it off, because A, it makes you fail more. B, you feel bad, you feel weighed down. And if people can get to that point of just accepting that they might fail, they're liberated. So whatever they've got, whatever ability they have, they can express it fully. And again, good things are going to happen.
I have to say thank you again for writing these articles. It came at a very good time for me professionally. I just finished a team meeting with my team after I it was before I read the first article. And this reinforced what we did. We came up with what we called the FU Award. Mm. And you can put whatever acronyms you want on there. But we called it the Fouled Up Award. And it's an award that you can nominate yourself. You can't nominate anyone else. You can only nominate yourself. And we are going to celebrate failure. And more importantly, what was it that you failed at and what lessons were learned. And we're going to share that as a team. Taking that, what you just said, it was just brilliant. It reinforces, I think, not only in sports, but in life in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you can create that culture, if you will, in a family or in a business or in a sports team or a running club, it just makes it so much easier. Because we're bombarded by these unhealthy messages about success and failure from the internet, from the world. And it's hard to resist messages that are sent so consistently and from so many sources. So if you can create a mini culture, a mini community that provides you with a different meaning for failure and makes failure acceptable, not desirable, but I can live with it. Mm-hmm. That makes it so much easier to take off that weight vest and embrace that failure might come.
And we've heard some people take off that weight vest, that metaphorical weight vest, by signing up for a race in a different name, a pseudonym, so it doesn't show up on results. And they could just go out and I think that's extreme, and I'm wondering if it's just folklore or it really happens. But they go out there as somebody else then and just feel liberated and free and run as they feel. And I've got to think that's a part of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of not the best way to do it, because it sort of artificially and somewhat dishonestly takes the weight vest off. But it's the idea behind it is that there are no expectations, there's no pressure, there's no worry about what people will think. Because again, ultimately, the only people who really care are us, maybe immediate family. But of course, hopefully your immediate family and your friends will still love you. So it really what it's about is just letting go of all that crap, which doesn't matter. Which paradoxically enough, when you let go of that fear of failure, you're more likely to find success.
So, Dr. Taylor, let's look back and forward at the same time. Back to the beginning of part one, where we talk about why children feel fear.
Fear failure.
Say it once slow. Why children fear failure and going ahead, letting go of this fear of failure in your part four of the series. And I know that many times that problems that we have psychologically, emotionally, as children, don't automatically go away at 18 or 25 or whatever age. Sometimes we carry things through for a lifetime until we learn how to deal with them and shed them so they don't become part of who we are. And so with that, and as part of your introduction, not only a sports psychologist, but also parenting and business. So on the parenting side, what can we do as parents so that as we're raising children, that we can say the right things and not instill this fear of failure? And of course, this obviously circles back to us as individuals and as athletes. So with that, sir, is there a question in there?
Yeah. How do we deal with that?
Yeah,
fear?
No, I got it.
And avoid it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my phone just rung.
No problem.
I'll turn it off.
That was
so,
fear
yeah,
calling.
Exactly. Grim Reaper calling.
And he's not going to answer it.
No, I'm not going to answer by God. One of my parenting books is a fundamental thesis is that children become the messages they get the most. Children become the messages they get the most.
Yeah.
And so kids aren't born with fear of failure. They learn it from culture, from coaches, but most fundamentally from their parents. And so if parents can instill fear of failure, they can uninstill it by changing the messages that they send their kids. And there are three ways that the kids get these messages from their parents. One is as role models. So if parents, when they fail, they freak out, the message there is that failing is really bad. They also get it from direct messages from their parents, however unhealthy they are. Like, if you don't win today, I'm going to be really mad at you. Or when they do win, they lavish them with love and attention and gifts. Clearly not healthy, although I've seen some really painful examples of that in my work. And the third is, what is the third? I forget what the third is. But anyway, my point is that for parents to change their kids, they can change the messages that they send. And so for parents to really look in the mirror and see, so, you know, what kind of a message am I sending? Oh, yeah, number three is emotions. So your kid comes off the field after a soccer game and your face is gnarled in pain because they lost. Or, you know, I tell parents, if you can't handle your emotions watching your kids perform, don't go. Because you can say all the right things about how way to go, good job. But if you're emotional, if you're upset, they see that. And the message is, oh, my gosh, I made my mom and dad upset. So changing those messages are very important. Now, it's interesting you say that. You make that point about how we carry a lot of our stuff into adulthood. And we almost always do unless we make an effort to undo the stuff, therapy or reading or whatever it might be. And so, I mean, I work with adults in the business world who are very successful in many ways who have this profound fear of failure. And it is a challenge. I mean, entire books have been written about it. You can go to psychotherapy for months and years on end trying to figure this out. But a few basics are just recognizing that it isn't life or death. And so sort of reality testing your perceptions. Oh, my gosh, if I fail, it's the worst thing in the world. Well, you failed and, you know, I'm still alive. People still love me, still like me. I'm still okay. So reality test these perceptions that really are not accurate. And they're not accurate, meaning failure isn't such a bad thing. I mean, I will survive. And then slowly taking risks, looking for opportunities where you can put yourself out there just a little bit and see what happens. And see, oh my gosh, I survived. So you start to collect data around what happens when you have failed. And you have to start small because you're not going to take the big leap, that's for sure. But if you start small and you go, oh, that wasn't so bad, I'm going to take another little risk and see what happens. And it's like, oh, wow, I'm still okay. And you start going farther and farther until you at some point recognize, I'm going to take this very big risk. And I survived. And once you get enough data, if you will, then you sort of like retrain your brain away from that fear reflex toward a take my shot reflex.
You said in the beginning about some of the things that we shouldn't say as parents or even as coworkers or, you know, just another person that's communicating with this competitor, whether it's in business or in sport or whatever, not to provide them with gifts or negative emotions or negative comments. That then I'll ask you, what should we say? What are some positive reinforcing things that we can say to enhance the next performance?
Yeah, well, if somebody fails, don't be upset about it, that's for sure. Don't say anything bad about it, like you really screwed up or that was really bad. Or if you're a parent, be really upset about it. You know, say it's okay, you failed, so it didn't work out. Okay, so what, it feels bad, doesn't it? So you acknowledge the feeling and mm-hmm. say, okay, how can you not have that happen again? And so you get them focused on lessons learned and then how to turn that toward the future of what can you do about that in the future? Or put it in perspective is, you know, we fail all the time. You can tell the 409 story. How's that one? That people love that. or the J.K. Rowling story. And so what happens is you're putting failure in perspective for a kid or for a coworker. So it's not that big a deal. And then you give them the tools to help them succeed in the future.
You know, I've helped with the high school football team on the sidelines over the last 18 years, and I've watched the post game discussions that as the coach brings the team together and listen to the discussions on both winning and the losing when it happens. And what I've recognized and I believe is I would wish upon a student to have probably gained the best experience and learn the most from a 5-5 season, not a 10-0 or an 0-10, but the 5-5 season gives a real good look of reality and life's lessons. And so I would really root for those split seasons.
Yeah, and I usually put it 70-30, but you're right, absolutely right. You want a good substantial part of a person's experience to be failure. Because
which side's a 30, doctor?
No, 30's the failure.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You need success. Otherwise, it's just not very fun. But it teaches those lessons. It gives people opportunity to figure out how to deal with failure. It shows them that they will survive. And so because plus you need the success because A, it feels good. B, it shows you what you need to do to succeed as well. So you need some of both, whether 5-5 or 7-3. You know, we're quibbling about numbers there.
is there damage done by over-celebrating success?
Absolutely. Because if you over-celebrate success, then what are you going to do when there's failure? You're probably going to over-attack or over-criticize failure. And that doesn't mean people can't revel in their successes, but life is not just a big win and then you're good. Life is a series of successes and failures, and you just keep tooling along. So I think, yeah, be super excited about having done well, but then come back down to earth and get up the next day and life goes on. I mean, I can assure you I've had some really good personal successes in my running and my triathlon career. But what's interesting is the next day my life hasn't changed a bit.
So
that's the way life is.
So give me your opinion on the culture that we have developed for soccer, where every kid gets a trophy, whether they win, whether they lose, whether they rode the bench, whether they were the star, everybody gets a trophy. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, don't even get me started on that, guys. Don't even get me started. But in a nutshell, I'm after your first year of Pee Wee soccer, Pee Wee football, or Little League soccer and baseball, what have you, get rid of them. Because yeah, the little trophies, little kids like them, and it motivates them a little bit. But after that, it gives people a distorted view of the world.
Yeah.
That's you just need to show up and you get a trophy. Well, that doesn't work in sports, in school, and in business. And no, you don't want to vilify the people who don't, who ride the bench or don't play well. But they need to learn that, okay, they're on the bench now. Well, what do you need to do to get off the bench?
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't get rewarded for just showing up. You have to do the work. So, and then these days the trophies get bigger and bigger. I see kids, especially for some reason at karate tournaments, and kids get these trophies that are bigger than they are, that are taller than they are. And it's like, come on, guys. And what's funny is kids usually just love doing the stuff, whatever the sport. They don't need the little trophies, really.
Yeah.
And so by giving them out, research has shown that when you externally reward an activity that's internally rewarding, it reduces the internal reward, the internal motivation. And so, yeah, so that's my little rant on that.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's attracted me to the ultra running or the ultra distance stuff is the ultra challenge piece of it, of testing myself not to be a quitter or to face failure square in the eye and take a swing at it and reproving to myself perhaps that, you know, I can get it done. And you may have a diagnosis for me before end of my comment here, but if you would just send it to me by email and not tell me over this podcast, it'd be great. So that really is, I think, one reason that I stick out there and love the competition against the trail and the course.
Makes sense, yeah. And because you're focused on the experience of it, how it challenges you, how you benefit from it, and you're not overly concerned about failure.
Dr. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. We could go on for probably another 2 hours on mm-hmm. this subject. It's such an intriguing subject for all of us at some level. If you want to know more about Dr. Jim Taylor, you can go to his website, drjimtaylor.com. He's written over 12 books. I started looking through the list of books earlier, and I thought, I think I need to get some of these books. There's also, he blogs on that. He does speaking. He does consulting. We thank you very much for your efforts in the community. We thank you for the time that you've taken with us and the nation today.
Sure, Don and Scott, the second time with you guys, always, as I said at the beginning, great fun, great pleasure. You guys are tremendous interviewers. You ask great questions, and so I'm glad to be here and always happy to return.
Well, I think you just created the new intro for Trail Runner Nation. Thank you, Dr. Taylor.
Very good. Good talking.
Have a
you
good
guys.
One. Thank you so much.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Don, that was this has been a really good article series to read, and I think if you dig into that article and reread it a couple times, read it, go out and for a run and think about it, and then come back and read it from a different perspective, whether it's with your relationships in your life, whether it's with business, whether it's with your kids. I think there's a lot of meaning here.
Well, I think you're right. I think you could look at it from a different perspective and read it with a different hat on each time and apply it somewhere.
Yeah, it's just good
principles.
Very good stuff. Very good stuff.
You know, this conversation reminded me a bit of Lanny Basham when we had him on mm-hmm. about how to interact with kids and things you say and questions you ask after a win or a loss that really focuses on the actual event itself
mm-hmm.
or the performance and not necessarily the scoreboard.
Yeah. I'll link that article also or that other podcast with Lanny Basham too to this podcast description. So if you're interested to go back and listen to that one, that's also a very good one.
You know, sometimes here on Trail Runner Nation, we do talk about how to run downhill faster or how to, you know, drink quicker through an aid station and different things that are real practical. But I think some of these discussions are just as important and just as meaningful, and they need to be applied out there on the trail as well.
Well, there's a lot that goes on between your two ears when you're running 100 miles, right?
Or 50 miles, or 25, or just getting up out of bed when it's cold outside and warm in the inside.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, this was one I've been waiting to do for a long time.
I had to hold you back in the beginning. You said, part one's out, let's do a podcast. I said, well, part one means there's probably another part coming up.
And it really was, it started as a three-part podcast, or three-part article series. And as he finished the third part, he said, you know what, there's a fourth part to this that we need to talk about.
And the cool thing about Dr. Taylor, he's an athlete too. He's done triathlons,
oh, yeah.
He's done runs, he's done ski team work. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff that where he can try his theories out and watch how they evolve with his athletes.
It's true.
So go and grab the article and run.
Moss.